Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
This episode of Silent Giants is brought to you by Ally. Ally, powered by Verizon locations, are developed by Verizon, the world's leading technology company, in collaboration with Ally, a membership-only community workspace for creators. Each location is a community curated, powered by the emerging technologies and thought leadership of Verizon. With Ally, Verizon is bridging the gap between startup and corporation by helping the community workspace build next-level ecosystems for entrepreneurs. Now, on to my episode
with Liberty DeVito.
You know what's amazing to me? Somebody said, put it this way, like, I have had a relationship with millions of people that I've never met. That was like, whoa, that's really intense. Because I get it all the time, you know, in emails. If it was because of you that I took up the drums, you are the soundtrack of my life, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, it's like, we were just guys in the studio just having fun.
Yeah, check it out. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge. Everybody tuning in, you invited. No matter what mood you in, get excited. Everybody love the music, let me tell you how they do it. Whether writer or an agent, let me tell you how they made it. You are now talking to a silent giant. Wanna walk in their shoes, silent giants. Wanna study they move, silent giants. Wanna know what they do, silent giants. Silent giants, y'all.
Welcome to the Silent Giants Podcast, a podcast highlighting the superstars behind your favorite superstars and creative industries. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge. To keep up with the latest on the show, be sure to follow us on Instagram at Silent Giants Podcast. To keep up with my life, music, and more, be sure to follow me as well at Corey Cambridge. This week's guest is drummer Liberty DeVito, the silent giant behind music icon Billy Joel. For over 30 years, he was Billy's touring and recording drummer, participating on classic albums like Turnstiles, The Stranger, The Bridge, and many others. You may also recognize Liberty for co-starring in Netflix's music documentary, Hired Gun. In this interview, we sit down to chat about Liberty's upbringing in New York, how he got into drumming, how he met Billy Joel and became his drummer, and lessons he learned along the way. An amazing interview from an amazing guy. So, without further ado, let me introduce you to the American rock and roll drummer, my friend, the silent giant, Liberty DeVito.
You can make it louder if you want.
Thanks.
I love volume.
Now this feels better.
Yeah, that's good.
Liberty, what up?
What's going on?
Yo, Liberty, you should be a rapper, man.
You think?
You got a rapper name.
Yeah.
It's almost like Beyonce.
Yeah, but like Liberty.
Can Beyonce sell you insurance?
Beyonce can probably sell me anything.
Well, I mean, if Beyonce wasn't...
Well, I think she'd be pretty cute walking down the street if she wasn't anything.
Right, but I feel like her name is such a brand. Like, yo, I'm Beyonce.
Yeah.
I'm Liberty.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big name.
Like it is a big name. But
your parents branded you well.
But, well, you know what? I'll tell you what. My real name is Liberatore.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, Liberatore. And
That's not even on Wikipedia.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
So don't do it.
I won't post it.
So I was named after my uncle. My father had five brothers. They all went into World War II. One didn't come back. His name was Liberatore.
Okay.
But they called him Liberty when he lived in Brooklyn. But he used to get in fights because the statue in the harbor is a woman. Statue of Liberty is a woman.
Gotcha.
So he used to get in fights because his name was Liberty. So when they named me Liberty, all the relatives said that my dad was insane for naming me Liberty because I'd be fighting for the rest of my life, kind of like the boy named Sue.
Yeah.
So what happened was in the 60s, all of a sudden, peace and love and liberty. Everybody wanted to be free. So it was the name to have.
Hey, man, you were branded very well.
I'm telling you. It worked out in show business.
People don't think about, yo, your name is your brand.
Yeah.
Liberty's like, dude, this dude right here, he's serious.
People don't forget it. If they do, they call me Victory or something like that. You know, your name is Victory. I met you once. No. You're close, but.
So we mentioned before we got started with the interview that how did I find you? Well, number one, I'm a
you know, my podcast is all about people behind the scenes. Right. And I went on Hired Guns.
I saw Hired Guns. Okay.
And I was like, yo, my man. And there was like a clip where you were in New York. Yeah. I was like, yo, I wonder if he still lives here. Because like I would say 70% of New Yorkers who are from New York live in Florida now.
You know what's funny? It's at the end when I'm walking down the street.
Yeah.
And I picked the leaf off the tree. You were probably on that block a million times.
Probably so. What block
was it? That's Washington Avenue between Fulton and Atlantic.
Yeah, yo. So that's my. So when I moved here, I moved to Putnam Avenue and Putnam and Classen.
There you go.
And I lived there for 3 years. So when I think of like home,
yeah.
I think of like Clinton Hill.
Yeah.
Biggie's old neighborhood.
Yep.
Do you go by St. James often?
All the time.
Yeah, they're always shooting stuff. I actually did an interview today with the guy who plays Tupac in Straight Outta Compton and in the new USA Network's Unsolved series.
Yeah, the Unsolved thing. Yeah, that should be cool.
That should be really cool. I got a chance to interview him today.
Yeah.
And he was like super cool. Super, super cool dude. And he's from Brooklyn. He's from Canarsie.
There's a lot of people from Brooklyn.
Yeah, by the way, I like your watch.
Oh, thank you.
I'm a big
Shinola.
Detroit.
Yeah.
I'm really big on watches.
Yeah, I loved it when I saw it in the magazines and I told my wife, oh, I want one for Christmas. And she...
And also, two of my favorite colors, like Masters Green. I was actually wearing a green sweater when you came in. Masters Green is like my favorite color.
I like it.
It's like the color of wealth.
It's great.
Just green makes you feel good, man.
Yeah, I could fool a lot of people with
it. Wait, so where are you from in Brooklyn?
Well, I was born in Brooklyn.
Yeah, where about?
I was born in Kings County Hospital.
Where is that?
My mother said it was called County Line. It was kind of like really close to Nassau County.
Okay.
Like out by Kennedy Airport or something like that. You know, close to that, but in Brooklyn. And growing up, my dad was a... for 6 months, we lived in Brooklyn. My father and mother weren't married when I was born.
You were born a rock star, man.
I was born a rock star.
It was meant to be.
So check it out. They finally got married. Like I was born, they got married in June and I was born in August. So figure out how long it was before they decided to get married. Right.
Yeah.
So my grandmother would not let my father live with my mother until he got a good job. So me and my mother and my aunt, my mother's sister, lived in a one bedroom furnished apartment, and it was so small that my mother used to pull it. The dresser was in the wall, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Old school thing. And she used to pull the drawer out, take everything out, make a bed in there. And I used to sleep in the drawer. But then at 6 months old, my parents went to the beach, Jones Beach.
Yeah.
On the way home, they stopped in Levittown and they were looking at houses and they liked the house that they saw. It was like a Levitt home. And the guy said, you like it? Why don't you buy it? And my father said, I don't have money, you know, to buy the house like this. And the guy said, are you a GI? My father said, yeah. He goes, how much money do you have in your pocket? My father had $3. He said, give me the $3. You bought a house.
What?
Yeah, that was the down payment. It's $3.
Yo, that's the come up.
Yeah.
That's the real GI bill.
That's it. That's it.
That GI three bills.
Yeah. Yeah. So we moved out to Long Island, my mother wanted him to get a good job, and he became a cop.
Okay.
In Brooklyn.
Okay.
And he actually was in the 77th Precinct, which was part of Prospect Heights, and still until the day he died, when I used to tell him where I lived, he used to say, "Oh, you can't go. Don't go there. You got to move. You got to get out of there because it was bad in the 60s, and you know."
Yeah, it was bad up until like 5 years ago.
Minutes ago.
Yeah,
yeah.
He was still scared.
Yeah, but I mean, he had, you know, they have the service revolver that they carry around. He used to bring it with him when he come visit. I said, Dad, what are you doing, man?
You know, it's funny. My best friend's dad is a cop or retired cop. And then his dad was a retired cop. So his grandfather was a retired cop as well. And the way that they see the world is completely different than
totally
how we
different.
See it.
Totally different.
Because when they associate things that they see, it's with bad or violence or danger.
Yeah.
When we got to walk through things like blind and like, hey, life is good.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was such a weird way that he looked at the world. I mean, he came out of World War II. He became a policeman. He was in the Battle of the Bulge, invasion of Normandy, all that kind of stuff.
Wow. You know?
And then I grew up in the 60s. you know, my hair was long. I looked like the guys he was arresting, you know?
Yeah.
It was tough.
Your mom, what did she do?
My mom was a housewife.
Okay.
She was great. My mom was the one that encouraged me to play. You know, she used to cut school to go see Frank Sinatra. She used to say my father was a square. He really didn't know much about music. And he used to go to the movies every time I wanted to practice the drums in the basement.
Wow. Was she really into arts, like herself?
She liked music a lot, yes. She liked music. She liked fashion. You know, she was always, like, dressed to the, you know, tee, and her hair was always done up.
Oh, the good old days.
Yeah, she used to change the curtains in a house. Every season, she would change all the curtains.
Hey, that's not cheap.
No, it wasn't.
That's very expensive.
I remember my father taking the credit cards when credit cards first came out.
Yeah.
And opening up where the garbage belt was and taking a scissor and just cutting them in half all the time.
So how did you get into playing music?
Well, I asked my father later on in life, why the drums? And he said, because they didn't make Prozac when I was a kid. So a cousin of mine was selling a set of drums, getting rid of a set of drums, buying new ones. Now, these were like drums from like the 30s. The bottom head was tacked on, and a big, gigantic 26-inch bass drum with a scene of a canoe going down a river and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they were mother of pearl. I mean, I wish I had them now. But so he was buying a new set of Ludwig, Red Sparkle Ludwig. So we took those drums, and I just started to bang on them. I've always loved music, like even before I had drums, you know, like the later 50s music and early 60s music.
Who were some of your favorite artists from that time?
Four Seasons, Dion.
Oh, yeah.
The Orlans. You know the Orlans?
No, I don't know the Orlans.
Oh, they did a song called South Street.
Oh, I would definitely have this playing in the background.
Yeah, I love the Crystals and all that, you know, the Ronettes. I got to play with Ronnie Spector for a long time, too.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
That's pretty tight.
Yeah.
Put that on the bucket list.
Yeah, so it was cool. I mean, I started to play drums in sixth grade. I joined the sixth grade school band, but I couldn't do the buzz roll for the Star Spangled Banner. And the teacher actually said to me, put the sticks down, DeVito, you'll never do anything with the drums. Boom. My dream. Done. Over.
And what made you keep going with
them? Well, it wasn't until I got, you know, when I went to high school, and junior high school and high school were in the same school where I lived on Long Island.
Okay.
Right? So I was walking around once, and, you know, the girls love sports. The guys that played sports in my high school. So I can't play sports. I can't do it. I tried playing baseball. The ball was hit. I swore it was coming towards me. It landed way over there. That's when I found out I needed to wear glasses, right? So now in the 60s, the glasses were like Buddy Holly glasses, you know, really thick lenses.
Yeah,
and
like
black
the Coke bottles.
Yeah. So here I am walking around the school, and I'm wearing Coke bottle glasses, and I don't play sports, and I'm looking at these other people that are called girls, and I want to meet some of them. What am I going to do? February 1964, my heroes were on TV. On the Ed Sullivan Show, the Beatles were on. And I looked at the TV. We saw them in black and white, and I noticed that the Beatles, after the camera showed the Beatles, the camera turned and panned the audience, and all these girls were screaming at these not that good-looking guys. And then I looked at my sister and her friends, and they were screaming at a black and white TV at these not that good-looking guys, and I said, screw the buzz roll. That's what I want to do. I want to do that. You know, being a band.
Yeah, of course. Know,
it makes girls go crazy. And actually, so right after that, I started a band with a bunch of friends because the next day everybody bought guitars and drums and everything, you know. And started a little band, a little combo. We had an instrumental band, and we played at a high school dance. And the next day when I walked in after that, the drums gave me an identity. Like, I became somebody. Like, oh, you would have got to play last night. You were the drummer that played last night, you know.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, this is cool. This could work.
And were you a good student?
No. No, like my father says, I didn't mind going to school and I didn't mind coming home. It was that part in the middle I couldn't stand.
You fall in love with playing the drums.
Yes.
Before the drums and before music, what did you want to be?
Well, believe it or not, like in 1960, I thought, you know, maybe I'd be a clown.
Really?
Yeah. I was fascinated by the circus.
What inspired that?
I don't know. There was a song, something about a clown or something like that, and I used to sing, and I thought, well, being a clown could be cool. You know, making people laugh, and yeah. Nobody really knows who you look like. You know?
Well, you're a funny guy.
Yeah, well.
And you have a big personality. Makes sense.
Yeah, I guess I could be a clown.
Well, I mean, you could be a performer. Like, yeah. It all goes into performing.
Yeah.
You know,
I am a performer.
Yeah, you're a performer. But, you know, well, a clown was like,
trying to get out of that hole now.
I didn't mean it like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So.
No, I agree with you. You need a... My mother always said, she felt sorry for people who didn't have a sense of humor.
Yeah.
They'll never make it in this world because you need a sense of humor. You need to laugh about things, you know, because usually things that happen to you, years later, you're going to laugh about them when you talk about it.
Exactly.
You know, no matter what it is. So, I looked at the world kind of in a funny way, you know, like things were funny to me.
So I'd be a clown.
Yeah. I like the big shoes, you know.
Wait, did you ever tell your parents that you're like, mom, dad?
No.
They were like, man, you better go back to school.
Let me tell you something. My report card had more red on it than anything else. You know, D's and nothing.
You know what? I mean, but I think that goes into your career. But I was never really that good of a student, especially towards high school.
Yeah.
I don't like being defined by rules. I break rules.
Yeah, well, you're what is it, the square peg trying to get into a round hole.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the way we were, you and me. Look, we could have been brothers. Maybe we're related. We're related.
Well, we're definitely neighbors.
Well, you know, we're definitely neighbors. And my mother's side is Sicilian. So, you know, they came from Africa.
Well, I always say Italians and black people are very closely knit.
Yeah.
All about the food, all about the party, yeah. All about family.
Yeah.
Filipinos as well, very similar.
Yeah.
Like
Greeks.
Greeks. A yeah. lot similarities in the culture. You're in high school, right? Or you graduate from high school. What was your next step out of high school?
Well, even in high school, I remember a friend of mine said, you got to see, I was a junior in high school, and the seniors had a band. And the next day in school, my friend said, I saw Ronnie Levine's band. You got to see them. They're great. They're unbelievably great. Oh, my God. You got to see these guys, right? Okay. So I go. I'm with my girlfriend at the time. And we're waiting online to get in the club. And because it's an underage club, they didn't sort of booze. They just, soda.
Yeah.
Out in Plainview. It was called the My House. Ronnie, the guy, walks out. And he passes me and he comes back and he goes, what are you doing? And I said, nothing. And he said, our drummer's getting drafted. Do you want to play with us? It was like, boom. The next day, I was in the band. He lost the spot. I got the spot. So this is the club now where I'm playing in a band called the New Rock Workshop. And there's another band playing that's called the Hassles. And Billy Joel is in the Hassles.
Okay.
So this is where I first meet him, but just... enough to pass him in the hallway and say, hi. That's all. Hi.
Because you guys went to the same high school.
No, he went to Hicksville High School. I went to Seaford High School.
Okay.
One town away on Long Island.
Okay. Okay. Now you're in this band. Was it popular? Was it doing really well?
Oh, yeah. We were doing great. I mean, the crowds were coming, the people come to see us. And as a matter of fact, two guys that used to come to see us were Doug Stegmaier and Russell Javers, who jumped fast forward, were in Billy's band too.
Okay.
From that band, Mel Wax was the guitar player, and we played at that club. We opened up for a group called the Vanilla Fudge.
Okay. Right? Interesting name.
They were huge in the 60s. They Keep Me Hanging On. The Supremes Keep Me Hanging On,
yeah.
But really slow.
Okay.
You know, they were really heavy and like crazy. And somebody had told me that we were gonna open up for them, and they said they're playing tonight at the Action House, a place in Oceanside. I went down to see them, and I tell you, I was blown away. They were so good, you know. I mean, Carmine Appice was the drummer in the Vanilla Fudge, and I just copied him immediately after that. But in the meantime, Vinnie Martell, who was the guitar player, liked to jam. So me and a friend of mine named Ivan used to jam with Vinny in the back of their management company.
Okay.
So, but now I'm 18.
Okay.
I'm 18 years old. Still in high school, though. Just getting out. I'd say it's 68 now.
Okay.
Right. I'm just getting out of high school. And what happened was we're jamming with Vinnie Martell from the Vanilla Fudge. And this guy, there was a band called Mitch Rotter and the Detroit Wheels. Well, Mitch had split from the Detroit Wheels. So the Detroit Wheels came to New York. They had a drummer named Johnny B. Mitch Rotter and the Detroit Wheels, they had Sock It to Me Baby, Devil with a Blue Dress, Jenny Takes a Ride.
Okay.
All that kind of stuff like that. The Wheels come to New York. And they stop at this management company and they say, we're losing Johnny B. We're looking for a drummer. The guys in the management company say, there's a kid in the back that jams with Vinny. He's pretty good. I get the gig with the Detroit Wheels. So because they're so out of it at the time, the Detroit Wheels, we do one gig in Hershey, Pennsylvania. We drive all the way out to Hershey, Pennsylvania. And the band actually breaks up, but I drive with the band to Detroit. And I hang out and I with the lead singer.
And you're out of high school at this point now?
Yeah, I just graduated.
Okay.
I graduated in June. It is now summertime.
Okay.
So I finally fly home and I'm just hanging out at the house doing nothing, you know. And I get a phone call. And the guy's, it's Mitch Rider's tour manager. And he says, we got your number from one of the guys in the Wheels, and we need a drummer. Our drummer got sick. Now, the drummer that got sick was Johnny Siomis, who turned out to be the drummer that played on Frampton Comes Alive, which was the biggest live album at the time.
Yeah.
But so he got sick. I said, they said, we need a drummer. I said, when do you need me? They said, tonight. I said, can I do it tomorrow night? My father has to drive me into the city. I still didn't have a driver's license yet. So he drives me to the city. I get on the bus with the guys. And the sax player, when we set up, the sax player says, look, I'll just give you this, you know, with the stop and with the go. Luckily, I was a Mitch fan and I had played with the Wheels, so I know how a lot of the songs went.
Yeah.
So am I allowed to say foul language on this?
Fuck yeah.
Okay. So, end of the show. Now, you got to imagine this. The bus we're touring on is just like a regular bus that you take from, you know, Clinton Hill.
It's like a city bus? A city bus?
Yeah. It was called the Miko Tours or something like that. You know, regular seats and stuff like that.
Okay.
So, I'm sitting in there. Now, you got to remember, 1968, my hair is down here, right?
Yeah.
Like really long, curly, really long. I'm wearing jeans, bell-bottom jeans, and I'm wearing a Nehru shirt that's green paisley.
Yeah.
With bell-bottom sleeves. Thinking I'm the coolest guy. I just played with Mitch Rider. So the guys are coming on the bus, the band. He's got a band. It's called the Spirit Field, his band now, right?
And it's got
horn players and everything in it. They're slapping me. Good job. Mitch comes on the bus. I'm thinking, it's going to be so cool. Goes right past me. Goes to the back of the bus. Comes back up. Sits right next to me. He goes, did you have fun? I said, yeah. He said, did you like what you did? I said, yeah. He said, would you like to do this forever? I said, yeah. He said, blow me. And he walked back of the bus. I thought, shit. It's done. It's over. And I see the guys giggling and stuff like that. And then they said, he'll be back. So he came back and I ended up staying with him like for 6 to 8 weeks on this tour up and down the East Coast.
So at 18 years old, you're touring.
I'm touring at 18 years old.
It's really amazing that you're able to, like, your career started kind of right away. Like there wasn't,
right away.
There wasn't like a, you know, I served ice cream for a little bit.
No.
Over the summers and.
Nope. No job, no nothing.
What did your parents say about that?
Oh, they were excited. My mother loved Mitch Rider. She loved it. It was like, you're going to play with Mitch Rider? Wow.
And what did you learn from that touring experience, like being a drummer in that band?
Was to, my time, when I do a fill, my time has to match when I'm just playing a beat. You know, that's why I had a problem. I would rush my fills. You know, being a rock, white rock guy, you kind of tend to do that. But those albums that they told me to get, they were so laid back, the drums, that that's where I learned, you know, you lay back, man.
Wow.
And you know, you keep learning as your career goes on. I remember one guy, after Mitch Ryder, one of the two of the horn players started a band in Baltimore. So I went down there and lived down there for about 3 months. What a joke that was, though.
what was that a joke?
It was in Townsend or something like that. It was
Towson.
Yeah.
Towson.
Yeah, something like that. There was a club called the, what was it called? Hollywood Park. The building was built in 1910. And you could go, we slept upstairs of the club. And you could take a ball and roll it from one end and it would go, ooh, 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 and just settle in the middle.
Because the club dipped in?
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember the bass player telling me, the bass player was a funky guy, you know, Walter Bailey was his name, really cool. He had just gotten out of the Army. And he felt the tension in my playing. And he said, no, man, just grab the sticks and barely hold them. And just do it, you know. And it's like people say, well, you must have some muscles in your arms, you know, because you hold the sticks. No, you can pull them right out of my hand. That's how loose you hold them.
Wow.
You know? So I learned a lot from listening to these guys and always being the youngest guy in a band, you know, and always playing with guys that were better than you. That's how you get better. Yeah, so after that, I come home and I'm not doing anything. And I hook up with this guy, Richie Supa. Richie Supa, he was in a band called the Rich Kids. Now, Richie has had a deal with Paramount Records to do an album.
Okay.
So we're playing with him. We're working out stuff. We go to Atlanta to do an album. And we do this album with guys from another band that eventually became the Atlanta Rhythm Section.
Okay.
So it's my first time ever recording.
And oh, wow.
It was such a great lesson to learn. The producer's name was Buddy Bowie. They did all those Stormy and Spooky and those songs from the 60s and stuff like that. So it was really cool living in a hotel room. You know, we're all piled up on each other because nobody's got any money, so we're all in one room.
Yeah.
And recording in this studio, you know, the Atlanta Rhythm Section. They weren't called that yet, but they became the Atlanta Rhythm Section. The album comes out. We go on the road. I flip the van. And believe it or not, break every bone in my face.
What?
Yeah. We're coming home from Cleveland. We just had opened up for Grand Funk Railroad. And we're coming home from Cleveland. I'm on Route 80 in Pennsylvania, just coming into Pennsylvania. And I slipped on black ice. And I dove into a ditch, rolled up a hill, and then back down again.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And my face hit the steering wheel. You know, back then, no seat belts, you know, there was nothing. So I'm in the hospital. Supa has to pick me up out of the snow and carry me on his back up the hill to get to the highway again.
Well, and how was everyone else in the band?
Yeah, were they okay? Only one other guy.
Okay.
Flip, our roadie. Flip had the perfect name because he was a bit flipped.
Was he okay?
He saw it coming and he braced himself with his hands on the ceiling and his feet on the dashboard and rolled with the van.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So luckily, a tractor-trailer truck pulled up, saw it happen and stopped. And because now I'm sitting with the front windshield all over me, sand and snow and everything on me. And what happened was I broke this part of my face, all this pushed out, my nose broke, everything. My eye fell into my sinus pocket. So I'm looking through one eye, but blurry. And I can just see the lights of the truck blinking. And I can hear him talking and telling Supa, get him in the car and go to the next exit. I will radio ahead. The police will be there and they'll escort you. Because it's snowing like mad. They'll escort you to a hospital.
Wow.
Went to the hospital and I stayed there for a few days until my... You know, the operation took 4.5 hours to put me back together again. One guy did it. know, and my parents had to come pick me up.
And so you, and then you went back to New York.
I looked like a freaking monster.
I could only imagine.
Like a monster. My head was so swollen that they had to wait like days before they could operate for it to go down a little bit.
And like how long were you sidelined from like playing or?
Jeez, I was sidelined for about 6 months. That's when I got a regular job.
After I almost lost my life.
Because the girl I was dating at the time, we got engaged after that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
She lived through it with me. I thought, okay, this girl's good. We got engaged. And but I had a friend. As a matter of fact, I still have a friend. I spoke to him today. His name was Bob Ray, and he was playing weddings. We went to high school together at this place called the Narragansett Inn on Long Island.
And pardon me, what was the regular job you worked?
Oh, it was Fala mailman.
You were a mailman?
No. You know the junk mail you get, the big envelopes that fill with everything?
Oh, yeah.
This contest.
Like circulars? Yeah. Circulars?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You fill those envelopes. That's what I did.
Oh boy.
Right. I did that. I worked for a company that made aluminum siding. The guy was another one of those Vietnam vets, and all he wanted to do was fight all the time. You know, it's like, I can't do this. This is really... So anyway, Bob Ray always wanted me to play weddings. You know, go to the Narragansett and sit in for him and play the weddings. And I was like, no, there's no way I'm playing weddings. No way. So finally, he says to me, look, I told him you're coming. So he kind of made me a deal that I couldn't refuse, you know, one of those. And he lent me his tuxedo. My hair's still long. I'm wearing a tuxedo, his, and I'm using his drums. And I go there, and the guys I'm playing with, there's a sax player that's slick back hair, smoking cigarettes, drinking scotch, you know, that kind of guy,
yeah.
Older guy, a guy playing trumpet, and an accordion player, and me. And I'm sitting there thinking, what the hell am I doing? I played with Mitch Ryder. This is the end of my career. It's all over. These guys, I don't know how they're going to blow the horns. They're so old. I don't know how this guy's holding up this, you know. All of a sudden, you know, I'm thinking, oh, I'm the greatest because of what I did before. All of a sudden, the trumpet player turns around and says to me, the bride wants to start with a merengue. I said, what the hell is a merengue? Well, from that day on, I learned more than anything else I ever did was at that wedding. I stayed there for 2.5 years.
Wow.
You play so much ethnic music and music that the people in that party want to hear that you might not be familiar with, but you will learn really fast how it goes.
Yeah.
You know? So then when I got with Billy Joel, and we had the hit Just The Way You Are,
mm-hmm.
Everybody was freaking out. Like, how did you come up with the stick and brush thing, you know, and Just The Way You Are? Well, it's easy. The bossa nova is stick and brush.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
You ever read The Alchemist?
Yes.
By Pablo Coelho?
Yeah.
And to anyone who's viewing the interview, if you get the chance, read The Alchemist.
Yeah.
And that scene of you being in the weddings is like when he got stuck in that town,
yeah.
And he was like selling glass, you know, but through that experience of selling.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
In glass where he thinks like I'm not doing anything and
right.
Like what the fuck's going on, I'm kind of like wasting time, right. That's when you learn your greatest lessons.
Yes, and that takes you to the next thing.
Exactly.
You got to get on the ride somewhere,
yeah,
to go to the next spot. you know, and I eventually got all the guys that I was playing with, you know, rock and roll in that band, in the wedding band.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so that was 2 years of you doing weddings.
2.5 years.
Also, two weddings are great because they're consistent.
Yeah.
They're every Saturday.
Well, it was you would have a Friday night, sometimes a double on a Saturday, and a double on a Sunday.
Mm.
Now, I know—
You were making money.
Well, I know bands today, like, they make anywhere from $7,500 to $12,000 to play a wedding. We were making $35 a piece, union scale.
Okay, okay. But it's consistent.
And it was the 70s, so it was 71 or something. I had to join a union to go to do the weddings.
You know, after the wedding part of your career, how did you, you know, link up with Billy? What's the story behind that?
Well, I was playing weddings. We had a band called Topper. Myself, Doug Stegmaier, Russell Javers, and this guy, Howie Emerson. We were doing all original material, all Topper stuff, you know. And we were playing in bars, but we played blues songs too. And we were playing reggae then too, because we discovered reggae was like, whoa, this is really cool. Let's do this.
Yeah.
And so Billy was living in L.A., making albums with studio musicians and going on the road with other musicians. He needed a bass player. He called Doug Stegmaier, who was in Topper, because the sound man knew Doug from high school.
Okay.
To fly out to L.A., play with Billy on the Street Life Serenade tour. Now, that's one album after Piano Man. Mm-hmm. So there's Piano Man, Street Life Serenade, he's out. Doug goes out there. During that tour, Billy tells Doug, I want to move back to New York, and I want to get a bunch of guys to play with me. I want the same guys to play on my record that go on the road with me. And I want a New York-style drummer. And Doug said, you know the guy. You've met him in my house.
Yeah.
You know? So I still had to audition for Billy when it came back. And because there was other guys that wanted the gig. And so I learned all his songs. And it's funny, you know, because my mother loved R&B. She loved Aretha Franklin, Sam and Dave, and all that kind of stuff. She really loved Jackie Wilson, was one of her favorite artists.
Jackie's awesome.
Yeah. And I was practicing to Billy Joel's songs downstairs in the basement of my parents' house. And my mother came down and she goes, you're going to play with that guy? I said, yeah.
Tough critic.
Yeah.
Tough critic.
Yeah. So anyway, I do the audition. I play the songs that he plays in his show. He was impressed. And then he said, look, I'm making a new album and I'm going to run you by some of the songs that I'm going to do on the new album, see what you come up with. And he was pretty amazed at how fast I caught on and came up with stuff. He didn't know for 25 years that Doug Stegmaier had given me a tape of all the stuff he was going to do on the new album before I went to the audition.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
The cheat code.
Yeah.
Shout out to Doug.
Yeah. So the three of us went in the studio.
Okay. And what studio
now,
did you go to?
Now Jim Guercio is producing Billy. Jim Guercio owned Caribou Ranch out in Boulder, Colorado.
Okay.
And he produced Elton John in Chicago.
Okay.
So he takes, Elton John had just fired Dee Murray and Nigel Olsen, drums and bass.
Okay.
He sets up Billy with those two guys in the studio. Billy hates it, fires Jim Guercio, comes out to Long Island, stays at the Howard Johnson's in Westbury, and we go to Hempstead in Ultrasonic Studios, me, Billy, and Doug, and record Turnstiles.
Some folks like to get away, take a holiday from the neighborhood. Hop a flight to Miami Beach or to Hollywood. But I'm taking a Greyhound on the Hudson River line. I'm in a New York state of mind.
While we're listening back to some of the tracks, Billy says, I really like a guitar here. And me and Doug said, well, we know guitar players. So eventually, all of the band Topper that we had became the Billy Joel band.
Wow.
With the addition of Richie Cannata, who played saxophone.
And what was what is this experience like going into the studio, you know, for the first time, you know, with Billy? And I ask this question a lot in the podcast of, do people understand the moment that they're in? I think that's a key thing to success, is understanding the moment and being present of in the present of, okay, this is an amazing opportunity. Did it feel like that at the time?
Yeah, it did feel like that because he was a great songwriter and he sang great, played piano, you know.
Amazing.
He was really good.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. Yeah. But, you know, recording is like an out of body experience because you are the guy now that's playing. And then you stop and you go in the control room and now you're the guy that's listening to the guy that was just playing.
Mm.
And you're critiquing that guy, you know. So it's like really weird, like to, wow, yeah, that's pretty cool, you know, because it feels good when you're playing it. You can tell when it's not right and when it is right, when you feel it.
Yeah.
And then, but then when you listen back, it's like, yeah, that's good.
And did you know, like going back, listening to the songs on the Turnstile album that, wow, like these are classics.
I knew that New York State of Mind would be a classic.
Yeah.
And Angry Man is kind of a production, you know, like it had a beginning and a middle and an end. You know, people don't know that you play the beginning first and you stop and then you do the middle, and you stop and then you do the end. You put them all together. You know, Scenes from Italian Restaurant on The Stranger was done the same way. It wasn't played all the way through at once.
And how long did it take for you guys to finish up the Turnstile record?
Oh, Turnstile took 2 seconds, you know, like.
Wow, that quick?
It was done really fast, yeah. Really fast.
A week? 2 weeks?
The basic tracks, probably.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is really quick.
You know which one took the shortest was the album Innocent Man.
How long was that?
That was 6 weeks done with the basic tracks. Done. And when Billy comes in the studio, when we go into the studio,
yeah.
Okay, we're going to start an album. He only really has 2 songs. He's got ideas, but only 2 songs that are complete at the most.
Well, and how does that process work? So he writes and arranges and...
No, he writes. He doesn't arrange.
And for the audience listening, what is the difference between writing and arranging a record? I know, but for...
A song is copywritten. The words and the music. Not the arrangement. That's why when somebody else does a song and changes the arrangement,
yeah,
they don't have to pay the artist for the arrangement. They pay the artist because he wrote the words and the music.
Got you.
The chord changes.
Got you.
But not the arrangement. That's your arrangement.
Got you. Okay.
You know.
Okay. Okay.
So he would write the words and music, and the band would, and the producer would do the arrangements. You know, like he would have bits and pieces. He never threw anything away. Like he would have an idea, like he had a thing that went dun 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 dun, and then it went to dun 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 dun. Right?
Yeah.
Well, the dun 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 became Uptown Girl. Whoa.
Ah.
And the dun 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 dun. It became a song called Blonde Over Blue on the River of Dreams album, the last album he did.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. So he never throws anything away.
And so when you guys finished that Turnstile, you know, record, how did that feeling feel for you?
Oh, it felt great. It was like, this is cool, because then we were going on the road because he had a contract with Columbia Records. So now we're going to go on the road. We made $400 a week.
A far cry from the wedding days.
And I don't remember. Yeah. And I don't remember getting paid to do the record.
Wow. Yeah, but you got points on the...
No.
No?
No.
So do session players typically get points on...
No.
So that you get paid...
You're work for hire, really.
Got you.
Unless it's worked out and you talk to the guy and say, look, dude, I helped you. You know, like
put together and build the track, like the song.
Yeah, like if somebody came up with when Rick James was in the studio and he had this song called Super Freak, and it just went She's a very funky girl. Ding, 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 ding. You know, but if somebody said, you know what it should do? It should go boom, 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 right? And then if he said to Rick James, look, I gave it a line. Do you think I can get a credit for as a writer? And Rick James could look at him and go, no, you're fired. Or, yeah, yeah, I think so.
Wow.
Yeah.
The music industry is very, very, that's one thing that, you know, one reason why I even started the podcast to begin with is to uncover those secrets about the music industry, because a lot of folks don't know that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, or even in the hired gun segment. Like, a lot of people don't understand what goes into the X's and O's of being a hired gun musician. Were you always had the urge to feel like, you know, you wanted to be heard or people to know what you've contributed?
Well, we thought we were a band. At least me and Doug and Richie.
Yeah.
We thought we were Billy Joel's. We were the band. Billy, me, Doug, and Richie were a band. And we were going to share and everything. Well, that didn't quite work out. No, because he was signed to the record deal. A lot of groups are like that. I think Bon Jovi, John Bon Jovi, and Richie Sambora were the only two signed to the record deal.
Wow.
The other guys are like, you know, side guys.
Wow.
You know, and it depends on how they're treated, how much the lead guy values them.
Do you remember your first show with Billy?
Yes. It was in, after we recorded Turnstiles, we did the overdubs, funny, at Caribou Ranch, where Jim Gersio, he owned Caribou Ranch.
Yeah.
After Billy fired him, we did Turnstiles. We went to Caribou Ranch to do the overdubs, and the mixes were done out there. And we played this place called The Good Earth in Boulder, Colorado. It was a bar. It was the first show ever.
And what was that like?
It was pretty exciting. It was pretty exciting. A little stage, you know. But we were used to that, playing little places. It was when we started to get bigger places that it was like, you know, a little bit of a stomach ache. The worst thing we did was, for a while there, we opened up for the Beach Boys with no billing at all. And, you know, the lighthouse lights would go out, you go up on a stage, and people are going nuts. And then the lights come on, and it's you. It's not the Beach Boys. And you could you could actually hear the crowd go, oh. And then you get hit in the head with a beach ball or something, you know, or a frisbee. Like,
oh, man. Oh, that has to be the worst feeling ever.
Terrible. And the Beach Boys were really nice to us, you know.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. And then Billy was getting compared to Elton John all the time.
Oh, my goodness.
You know? It was horrible until an agent said, look, you guys should be playing small theaters and stuff like that instead of opening up for these huge groups at the Chicago Stadium.
Mm. Also, too, because you've won a couple of Grammy Awards as well.
Yeah, but that wasn't until later.
Yeah, because when you win a Grammy Award, it's for the participation of being on the album as well?
Well, there's two Grammys that you want to win. You want to win Record of the Year and Song of the Year.
Okay.
Song of the Year goes to the guy who wrote it.
Okay.
Or the people who wrote it.
Yep.
Song that Record of the Year involves everybody that was involved because it's a great record.
Yeah.
Yeah, just the way you all would, Record of the Year, 52nd Street the next year won Album of the Year. I don't have any Grammys, though.
That's amazing.
I had to pay $50 each to get a piece of paper that said I was on Grammy Award winning stuff.
I'll take it. I pay $50 for it.
You get one if you prove it.
Well, I think that's the beautiful thing about music. You know, it's something that lives forever. Like, you can't ever take away your drums on those tracks.
No, they're there.
Like, they are there. Like, you are eternal. Like, music is an eternal thing as long as the earth is rotating. You know, that has to be a very, you know, I can only imagine being, you know, I don't have any kids or, you know, your grandfather, to be able to have my voice or my instrument or my talents live on long, 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 long time.
Yeah.
Like, well, you're still living.
You know what's amazing to me? Somebody said, put it this way, like, I have had a relationship with millions of people that I've never met.
Mm.
That's like, was like, whoa, That's really intense. Because I get it all the time, you know, in emails. If it was because of you that I took up the drums, you are the soundtrack of my life, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, it's like, we were just guys in the studio just having fun.
What was your favorite show that you can remember?
Well, we did so many different, like, I love Australia because, you know, the country was beautiful and the people were beautiful. I loved playing in Philly. Philly was a wild crowd. They were great. New York was a great crowd to play. You're home, so you got to play harder.
Yeah.
Because they're, like, looking at you like this.
Yeah, dude, New York is the hardest place to play.
Oh, boy. It's tough.
You know, you give a great show in New York when they don't boo.
Yeah.
If they don't boo, you're a great job.
No, and we did shows. In 1979, we went to Cuba and played. There was an exchange thing that Columbia Records did with the Cuban government where 150 Americans went. We went, Tito Puente went, Weather Report went, Stephen Stills, Bonnie Bramlett, people like that. And for a weekend, 5 days, there was, for every American band, it was a Cuban band that played. American band, Cuban band, American band, Cuban band. And that was an experience to see that country at that time. Man, broke.
Broke.
But the great thing is that I meet a lot of kids now that were at that show, that when Castro said, you know, get on the raft and you can leave. Remember they came over and a lot of people died.
Yeah.
They just sunk. They made it. And some of them were at that show.
Wow.
And they told us, you know, like what happened after we left, how some guys got arrested because they took T-shirts from us. And, you know, we were watched all the time. That was intense. And then in 1987, we went to the Soviet Union and played there.
How do you juggle family with you constantly being on the road? How does that work?
Well, let's put it this way. I've been married 3 times. I dropped a few balls here and there.
I didn't juggle family. Family juggled me.
No, it's tough. It's tough. I mean, my daughters, I got 4 daughters. The oldest one is 37, and the youngest one is going to be 1 on Saturday.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's 37.
So, wait, you just had a daughter.
Yes.
Wow.
So 37, 33.
Forever young, baby.
1.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. It's very exciting now because back then when the other girls were born, it was make an album, go on the road, make an album, go on the road.
Yeah.
And now I'm experiencing things because my wife works. You know, my wife is 42 and so she had to decide if she wanted kids or not. And I always said, kids are the greatest thing you can have.
Yeah.
You know? And so she decided, you know, time was ticking away and it was time. So she wanted a baby. And I said, sure, let's do it. And now I stay home. I'm the Manny. You know,
hey, I used to be a Manny.
What?
I was a Manny for 1 year in Greenwich, Connecticut.
How'd that go?
Dude, you know what it is? Liberty, it's one of those things in life that you're just grateful that you had the experience.
Yeah.
Like I don't know how many black rappers could say, hey, you know, before I made it big,
right,
I was a nanny. And also, too, it's good to see, it was an opportunity to see another way of life.
And do you have children?
No.
Okay, so you know now.
Yes.
What it's going to be like.
Well, yeah, well, the good and the bad, right? Because I was able to experience, you know, these folks came from the 1%.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So I was able to see the positives. You know, I come from a single parent home, you know, I mean, it's very normal. I would not poor, but not rich. And
hey, I'm an example of my parents staying together. I wouldn't say it's any worse or better, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things, everyone's situation, no situation's good and no situation's bad.
Right.
It's all about how we perceive it.
Yeah.
And so for me, I would imagine these kids that have all the opportunities in the world, because they come from the 1% and they have a lot of money. But I realized from that experience of being a nanny of like, dude, no, they have their own struggle. Like they don't know what the real world is like. They don't have a diverse group of friends. They don't, they're very sheltered from things. They don't know what adversity is like.
Right.
So they're hurting in a totally different way. And I learned a lot from that experience, from being a nanny.
Connecticut, huh?
Connecticut, man. And it was crazy because Diana Ross was my neighbor. Tommy Hilfiger was my neighbor. Like, I lived, like, on the whole bottom floor. The whole bottom floor I had to myself. And it was, like, overlooking the pool. I mean, I had, like, I called it the Manny Van. I had a minivan, and I would pick the kids up from school. I would make all the breakfast, lunch, and dinners during the summer. I would take them to camp and take them to the park and pick up their friends. And
wow.
It was like an all-day intense thing. Like,
that's wild.
And then I would come to the city and just blow all my money. Like, I would just find the nearest. Because I think about this, too. And something that another thing I learned while being a manny was the appreciation for stay-at-home moms. The appreciation for teachers, the appreciation for people that work intensively with the youth.
Exactly what I'm experiencing now.
Yeah.
Like, if I didn't hate my ex-wife so much, I would, like, post it on Facebook. Like, I sympathize with mothers.
Yeah.
I can't stand my ex-wife. So let me tell you something. You think I'm here to do this interview? I just wanted to get out of the house.
You know, let me talk to my wife. I'll be right there. There was no hesitation. There was zero hesitation. You know what? Let me just, like, check with my wife, and I'm there. And you're like, you know, I'm 15 minutes early. Hey, man.
And I went and got something to eat before I came here.
Yeah, because I guess, how did your life change, you know, from after being on the road with Billy? Like, how was your life? Did you feel...
Well, I mean, you don't get fired from a gig. You're just not asked to do the next thing.
Yeah.
That's what it's like. And you don't get no phone call. You don't get anything.
And that had to be a humongous transition, though, from having a lifestyle of 30 years.
I lived in the bubble for 30 years.
Yeah.
Like you said, you know, these kids live in a bubble.
Yeah.
You know, they don't know anything about the outside world. They don't know, you know. You get in trouble with the police and you play with Billy Joel. Yeah. Oh yeah. Go ahead. Go. You know?
Yeah.
Anything like that. You're in trouble. You meet somebody in the street and they want to beat you up. And then somebody says, he plays drums with Billy Joel. Oh man, brother. You know?
Yeah.
It's crazy living in that bubble. And then that bubble is gone. And then all of a sudden, here's the real world. You know, it's like when you were able to, like, run your credit cards up really high, buy anything you wanted to. And then all of a sudden, there's no more money. And it's like, uh-oh, now what do I do?
Yeah, how'd you cope with that?
Well, I have to tell you that if you saw Hired Gun, you know that Doug Stegmaier, when he got cut, he actually killed himself after a few years.
Yeah.
He just couldn't take watching somebody else play his parts that he developed. The guy was getting paid on stage to play something that Doug came up with. So Doug couldn't deal with that. I was lucky enough to have family as a support. And then when I wanted to get back on my feet again, I had a friend, Wayne Blanchard from Sabian Cymbals. And I used to always say, like, you know, the billing would be Libby DeVito, former drummer of Billy Joel. And he said to me, he goes, no, you are not the former drummer of Billy Joel. You are the drummer that Billy Joel chose to create those unbelievable hits and those unforgettable tours. That's who you are. And once I got that handle, it was like, yeah, that's who I am.
Yeah.
Like you said, that music will never die. It'll always be around. That record is always there to play for generations to come. And it's amazing to hear on the radio. It's still on the radio, you know, and it's bigger now than it was back when it was out. It's crazy.
And how does it, when you hear those records, like, how do you feel?
I feel like Billy's getting richer.
Well, does it bring back, like, good vibes of nostalgia and happy times?
I make myself immediately go to the studio when we recorded them because there was great times. We had great times in the studio. Great times. That was my favorite thing.
Yeah. And touring.
Australia. Touring was cool. But recording is like, yeah, we did it. And when it becomes a hit, it's like, we did it. I mean, everything became a hit. It's funny. The first gold albums and platinum albums we got, it would say The Stranger, platinum album, for the sale of 1 million copies. After I had the falling out with Billy, I got a little angry, and the Sicilian came out on me, and I smashed a bunch of albums. So when we sat face to face with our lawyers, to try to come to some kind of agreement on like royalties that I was supposed to get, internet royalties or stuff like that.
Yeah.
They said, what else do you want? And I said, can you replace my albums? And it's like, now where the old Stranger Gold album said 1 million records sold, this one says 10 million records sold, you know? Mm. It's like the amount of records, the greatest hits album, like 24 million copies sold. Sick.
Hey, is there something that you wish you had known about the business side going into it, if you could go back in time?
Oh God, I wish I knew that friends could be friends, but you really need to read the contract.
That's like an amazing quote.
Yeah. Because when I went back into Billy, I was suing him for royalties that I thought I was due from, because he had released the 25 years of The Stranger.
Mm-hmm.
And in that box was Live from Carnegie Hall, which I don't think we got paid for the recording.
Mm.
Right? So I was kind of suing him for that. And his lawyers found a copy of the contracts that we got to do the Bridge album, which was 9 or 10 albums after the first album that we did.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, there was one line that said, I give away everything, the rights to everything from this album back to the beginning. And you don't read it. You just sign it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because they keep saying, the managers say, oh, it's the same thing as last time.
Wow.
You know, and you trust these people.
Right.
And now you know that they're watching out for Billy. They're doing their job. That's their job to do that.
What was the quote again?
Yeah.
Friends can be friends.
But read the contract.
But read the contract.
You know.
And so how'd you end up being on Hired Guns?
What's that?
How'd you end up being on Hired Guns? How'd that happen?
Getting in the movie?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Well, the movie was Fran Stryin, who was the director in the movie.
Okay.
Was the videographer for Five Finger Death Punch, that band that Jason Hook is in. Jason Hook and him were on the bus once, and Jason said, I want to do a documentary. And Fran said, what do you want to do it about? And Jason said, me. Because Jason came from like Mandy Moore and stuff like
yeah.
that. Playing, and then became this heavy metal band. It's like insane.
Yeah.
And Fran said, well, I think you should do it something a little more interesting than you. And so they decided to do it about hired guns, you know, guys that have played with the main act and you're just a sideman. And Jason said, if we're going to do that, you have to get Liberty DeVito because he's played with Billy Joel for 30 years. He was a hired gun for 30 years, and that's unheard of in this business. So I was the first one to get a phone call. And the most disappointing thing about Hired Gun is what I'm wearing. Because I get phone calls all the time to do things like that.
Yeah.
And they never pan out. They come over, they do an interview, and then it kind of goes away. So I thought this was going to be another one of those. So I had these shorts on. Right?
I thought you looked all right.
Everybody else is wearing leather jackets.
Yeah, yeah, they did. Well,
you know, and I'm sitting in my living room, like bouncing on my rocking chair, pulling leaves off of trees. I saw that when we went to the preview, and I saw that. I'm like, damn, why did I wear that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the whole vibe, we were very relaxed.
And it's on Netflix and everything, you know?
It was huge.
Yeah.
It's huge. Like, the minute it came when I was like, yo, I got to watch this.
Yeah. I went to the NAMM show last weekend out in Anaheim.
Yeah.
Where they show all the new equipment. Man, I couldn't walk 10 feet without somebody stopping me and talking about the hired gun.
Yeah, and how does that make you feel? Like
I'm famous again.
Yeah, like, how does that make you feel, like, that you're being, you know, reappreciated again in the music community?
The best thing about the hired gun that I really appreciate is that we got to tell our story. Nobody knew, you know, people like people didn't know that we arranged the songs with Billy. I thought Billy walked in the studio and did everything.
Oh yeah, like literally, I make music and I'm still just in awe of how songs are made.
Yeah,
and like learning how like, oh, like that's how that writer was a part of this, or, you know, this drummer was on it, or like that guitar player didn't play on the record that I thought was on the record.
Right.
Yeah. There's a whole another side of the music business that people don't know. And I think because of technology, because of like, you know, things like Netflix or Amazon or Hulu and the need for content or podcasting, hence, you know, why we're here at this very moment, like people are now want to uncover those truths about the things they love.
Well, I still am amazed at some of the stories that I hear. Like I heard when Puff Daddy, we was called then, when he did the thing about Biggie.
Yeah. Song. No, I've been missing you.
And he used the Sting song.
Sting record, yeah.
Well, I saw an interview with what's his name, the guitar player from The Police. And he said that Sting had been...
Copeland.
Yeah. Yeah, Stuart Copeland's the drummer. Andy Summers.
Here we go.
Okay. Puff Daddy wanted the rights to the song. Sting did not give him the rights to Every Breath You Take. He kept the rights. Sting gets money from that song.
Right.
And the funny part is that the only part from that song that they used was the guitar part. That's the only thing he used, and Andy Summers didn't get
any money.
No, from that remake, Sting got the money.
Friends can be friends,
and Sting, and when Sting wrote "Every Breath You Take," he walked into Andy Summers and he said, "I wrote a great song, but you have to make it sound like The Police."
Wow, friends can be friends,
but read the contract.
Well, Liberty, thank you so much for being on the show,
this
man.
This was a gas, man.
I really appreciate you. You should get your own podcast.
Yeah,
You should.
Yeah, well, I'll have a one-year-old on my lap.
It get you out of the house.
It will.
You're the man.
Yeah.
I appreciate you, Liberty.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So great.
Thank you so much to the Silent Giants behind this episode of the Silent Giants Podcast. This episode has been mixed by Mark Bird of MBM Studios, located in Astoria, Queens, NYC's number one recording studio for music, podcasting, and other audio recordings. Be sure to follow them on Instagram at MBM Studios NYC. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge, signing off till next time.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.